Lovely exercise. So we went together. When we got to the top of this mountain, I saw another mountain in the distance, and I said, let's go to that mountain too. He said, no, one mountain's enough for me. He was much older. And so he went back to the hostel, and I went by myself to the next mountain. And I should have known, and the hostel warden should have also stopped me going alone, because when you go walking alone in the mountains, you can get into very deep trouble. And I did, because I could not believe that it was a beautiful sunny day with hardly a cloud in the sky. But by the time that maybe the hour from one mountain to another, the clouds had come in, and those clouds descended over the mountain, and I was enveloped in mist. And it was such thick mist I could not see the end of my arm. And people had told me stories that happened about a year previously in one of the big moors in Scotland. There was two Englishmen had gone walking, and they'd been stuck in the moor for 3 or 4 days. No food, no water, no place to sleep. And just going round and round and round, because in the mist you can't find your direction. And they managed to get out, and they were very lucky to actually to live. And it's a very dangerous situation. So, but I thought I was smart. Now, it's the arrogance of youth. The Buddha has a word for that, madayobana, the arrogance of youth, who think we're always really smart. And I thought, it's so easy to retrace your steps, turn around, go back the way you came, and then you can get off the mountain. And so I tried that, and I came across this cliff, which was just about this far in front of me, and I was one more step and I'd been over it. I was really lucky to find it just in time. And I survived, but I checked afterwards on the maps, and I'd gone in a totally 180% the opposite direction I thought I was going in. In the mist, or in whiteout, in snow, or in the darkness, human beings don't have a sense of direction. And that's an illusion to think you do know which way you've come. And that really shocked me, because I realized I was lost. And there were cliffs, and I could fall over them just so easily. Just one moment's lack of mindfulness, just one more step and I'd be dead. So it was very scary. So I thought, how can I escape from this mountain? Because that mist could be there for days. And I did a little bit of calm sort of analysis. And I found this very effective way of getting off the mountain. And I found a stream. Because I thought that water always goes downhill. So I just find a stream and follow it. It doesn't matter which way it goes. I know it goes down. And it doesn't really matter whether I went north, south, east or west, but as long as I went down to get under the mist. Because I knew if you go low enough, then you're underneath the cloud cover, and then you'll be able to see where you are. So that's what I did. I followed this stream as it zigzagged across the mountain this way and that way, joined other little brooks and streams, until it finally took me below the mist. And when I was below the mist, I could see where I was. It was a long way from the hostel, but at least I could see where I was now. I could find my way back. I was tired, late, but still survived. And that is obvious, isn't it? That you find water, follow it, you'll always go downhill, and you're only going in one direction, so you're not wasting too much time going round and round. Water doesn't flow in circles. And it goes down in one direction. And afterwards I thought, that's a great simile for overcoming doubt. Understanding what insight is, understanding what meditation is. When you have so much confusion about someone teaching you this and someone teaching you that, and wondering whether this really is insight or whether it's just another idea which isn't really truthful, does it lead downhill, out of the mist? Does it lead to more peace, more awareness, more happiness, less of these defilements such as fear and anxiety and anger? Does it lead to what you all know, no matter what religion you are, no matter what type of Buddhism you are, whether you've been a Buddhist a long time or a short time, you all know intuitively that these are good qualities which we're supposed to be developing. A sense of inner peace, happiness, kindness, gentleness, awareness. Those good qualities, if whatever you do enhances those, makes them stronger, It's like the water is going downhill. Follow that path. You follow it and follow it and follow it, because it's getting more peaceful, more clear, more happy, less problems, less anger, less fear, less guilt. And you find it goes in the correct direction until eventually you go under the mist and you can see everything. Now that going under the mist in this simile stands for streamlining. Now you can see where you are. Everything is really clear. But until you're a streamwinner, until you can really see the Dhamma and understand what the Buddha was talking about, it is like being in mist. We don't really know which way to go and how to go and what to really do and what is insight and what is not insight. And because of that, it gets very, very confusing. So we go in the direction which creates more peace, more kindness, more gentleness, now more sense of freedom, all those little wonderful things. Freedom is a very good indicator, as long as it's freedom from desire rather than freedom of desires. You know, you find your desires, your wants, your needs get less and less, which is a wonderful thing to do, because after a while you realize that what I thought were my friends, all these desires, wanting this and wanting that, it drives me crazy. You know, just all these things are, and I don't know about you, but I remember as a young man, I thought I really wanted something. Well, when I wanted it, when I got it, it was never exactly what I wanted. It was like the wants were unfaithful to me. They promised me all this happiness and satisfaction. That's what they promised, and so I worked very hard to get it. Once I got it, it disappointed me. It never lived up to its sales pitch. That's what desires are. And so, it just one desire after another, after another. Different types of desires. First of all, you have material desires. And then later on in your life, you have spiritual desires. I want jhanas. I want nimittas. I want stream winnings. I want something. And it's the same old thing. The same reason why you work hard at university. I want the degree. I want the first class honors. I want the place in the PhD program. And you want that. It's a good thing to want, but it's still more wanting. And then you go into life, and then you want the beautiful partner, then you want the kids, then you want the Ferrari and the mansion. And, well, maybe not that much. You know, I always said that I wanted a Ferrari. And one day somebody gave me a Ferrari. I got a Ferrari once. It's one of these little toy cars. They say, here's your Ferrari. It's not really what I wanted. So they know I've got a sense of humor, so they play up to my sense of humor. See, Ajahn Brahm owns a Ferrari. I think I gave it away. It's only a toy little car a long time ago. But you want all these things. As soon as you get it, it's never good enough. It's disappointing. So when you actually are practicing and you get less desires, it's not like you're stopping desires. You're thinking desires are bad. I shouldn't have a Ferrari. I shouldn't have a big car. I shouldn't have a new dress. It's not that. It's you don't need it. Why have it? It's the abandonment of desires. They vanish. You don't tell them to go. You don't force them out. They're just not there anymore. You're just happy with what you have. You're living a much more simple life. That shows you that insight is happening. It's working on you. And the calm is also working on your mind. The two of them working together are taking you downhill, taking you below the mist of delusion until you get to this wonderful place called streamwinning. At last you're under the mist and now you can see exactly where things are and you can understand what to do next. You can understand where Nibbana is and so off you go. But until that time we're stuck in the mist. So we have to make sure that the insights which create peace and happiness and stillness, they're the ones to develop. And if you can't know that, always ask people that when you finish your retreat, see how your partner relates to you, how your boss at work relates to you, how your friends look at you. Because they'll be able to see whether you're going in the right direction, even better than you can, because you can sometimes deceive yourself. You know, we only see what we want to see, and sometimes we can delude ourselves we're getting somewhere. But your friends can see it straight away, especially if it's a husband or a wife or your kids. They know you so well. And if it is the case that this is working, your partner will be so happy you're coming here. There's the old story that this years and years and years ago, there was this man who always wanted to go on just a weekend meditation retreat, just a weekend. And he asked his wife, there's a weekend retreat this weekend, can I go? No way. The weekend is busy. You've got to fix up all those jobs which I gave you. We've got to go to the shopping. We've got to take the kids to sport. There's no time. No, you can't go. Now, this was a very smart guy. Never argue, but just wear your wife down. That was Margaret Thatcher. She said, some cabinet ministers you beat down, some you wear down, and others you grind down. She said, Margaret Thatcher, she was a hell of a woman. But anyway, there we go. Sometimes we have, you know, in the nuns' monasteries, we've got to be very careful because some women are very strong and powerful. So when we first started Dhammasara, we called the head nun then the abbess. We had to stop that word because some of the nuns started calling her abyss. Abbess. So they would call her Aya. You know, the Aya is like venerable, like Bhante. And then one other nun became known as Ayatollah. So you've got to be really careful sometimes. They just call them abbots, just like the monks. You can't really mess around with that too much. But anyway, there's some very strong women. But this guy, he was very smart. So he just dropped it. The next time there was a retreat, he asked again, can I go on a retreat this weekend? No, of course you can't go. Mother's coming. You've got to fix this up. You've got to go to the dentist or whatever. Okay. And he kept on asking like this, and this is called wearing down. Because after a little while, the wife said, okay, you go on one of your retreats, leave me with all the work this weekend. So he did. But the story was, I remember him coming back, and he said that when he came back, just after a weekend retreat, he was such a beautiful guy, his wife saw the change straight away, and she was impressed. So much so, when it came time for the next retreat, he never needed to ask. She gave him the money and sent him off. It was a lovely little story. True as well, that she saw the results. Now that means things are happening. You get the insight that things are really going fine. Well, another girl who came here about a year ago, year and a half ago, from Sydney, an exec. And when she went back to work, sort of after the 9-day retreat, she sent a letter to me. Just in a nice jovial letter, thanks very much for the retreat, but you wouldn't guess what happened. The first day at work, my boss looked at me and said, you're really happy. What have they been giving you in Perth? Whatever drug it is, please bring me back some next time. Now, you actually see it there. So that's a great sign that the path is actually happening, that you are developing insight, you are developing calm, because the two go together. If it's just ideas, so you write a book, but you're a pain in the neck for everybody you live with, that's not insight. That's not calm. It's not creating the goods. What's the point of knowing everything and, you know, having the deepest understanding of Dhamma if you've still got your defilements and anger and greed and jealousy and stuff? It's not working. So real insight is what creates peace. And this is not just when you go home after the retreat. It's right now. So there are times when you're meditating here, you get really fed up. You don't want to meditate. You don't want to walk. You don't want to go and lay down. You don't want to have a drink. You've done that. You get into this beautiful state. I call them beautiful states because when your back's against the wall like that, just get some insight. You can ask yourself, what do I want? That was one of the main ways I got insight during my meditation. You were sitting there and nothing was working. You were just really discontent. Say, what do I want? I said, if I got it for you, would you be happy? No, not really. I want a cup of tea. If you had a cup of tea, how many cups of tea have you had in your life? Does that really make you happy? No, not really. Do you want to have a sleep? No, not really. Do you want to sort of go for a walk? Yeah, no, not really. What do you want? And after a while, when you ask that question, you realize it's just this restlessness. It's not you want something else. It means you're just not happy where you are. You're looking for something, anything. You're not quite sure what, but anything other than being here. So it wasn't really wanting was the problem. The insight saw it was ill will. Ill will towards what you're experiencing right now. So once you saw that, that was the insight, then obviously it's not the wanting was the problem, it was the ill will was the problem. Realize antidote to ill will is so easy. It's kindness, compassion, loving kindness. Open the door of my heart to this yucky feeling right now. When I open the door to this yucky feeling, you know that life is sometimes yucky. You know, so it's too hot, it's too cold, you eat too much, you haven't eaten enough. You know, another day of meditation, the people next to you in the cottage kept you up all night because they were coughing or banging or talking or on their mobile phone and all the things they're not supposed to do, but they do anyway. Whatever it was, you know, that sort of has made you sort of upset. So you learn how to be content. It's not the sound disturbs you. It's you disturb the sound. It's not your intestines disturb you. You disturb the intestines. The stomach ache is one thing, but you know the mind ache when the stomach is not settled, that's something completely different. So you give it loving kindness. And I sometimes call this the Nalagiri strategy, using an old story from the time of the Buddha on how to overcome nearly all of the hindrances when they're very, very strong. When you're really fed up, you don't want to meditate, you don't want to go home, you don't want to go to bed, you don't want to go for a walk. Ah! You've got the Nalagiri syndrome. And the Nalagiri story comes from this. In the time of the Buddha, even the Buddha people didn't like him. And they got angry at him, and they tried even to kill him, and assassinate him. So if somebody doesn't like you, if you've got an enemy, you're in good company. Even the Buddha had enemies too. So there's not one person in this world, in the Dhammapada it says, there's not one person who doesn't get blamed and criticized. There's not one person in this world who hasn't got an enemy. We all got enemies. We've all got friends. It's the nature of life. So don't think there's something wrong with you. If you've got an enemy, someone doesn't like you, they send you bad letters or whatever, say, wow, I'm the same as the Buddha. I'm at the Buddha's level. That must be okay. So people actually try to kill and assassinate the Buddha. And one of the plans was, if you ever go to some of these old countries, I was in England recently, the streets are just so tiny, they're so small. No, they're built for horses, not for trucks. You know, a horse isn't that big, it doesn't get past each other, but gets one truck and it gets filled up the whole road. And these were the very small streets in the time of the Buddha. And so the Buddha was going on alms round in this town, Rajagaha. Very, very small streets with his monks. And his enemy decided to make an elephant drunk, give him lots and lots and lots of alcohol, until the elephant was out of his mind. And then he pushed the elephant in the path where the Buddha was coming. And the elephant went charging down the path, out of his skull, violent like people in Northbridge on a Saturday night. Northbridge is the party district of Perth. Or in King's Cross, or wherever else you come from. Every city has their bad districts where you shouldn't really go at night time unless you want to fight. And this elephant was going there looking for a fight, smashing this and smashing that. And all the people saw the elephant coming, they were running away. And then they saw the very calm Buddha just walking calmly on. Get out of the way! A mad elephant's coming! He will kill you! And what happened next? All of the monks following the Buddha, who were all supposed to be enlightened and calm and peaceful, they scarpered, they ran, they climbed up trees, they jumped over the walls, they hid in the houses. They escaped. All except the Buddha and his faithful attendant, Ananda. And he stayed. Because Ananda, this character which we try and draw from the time of the Buddha, he just loved the Buddha. He was devoted to, he would do anything to the Buddha. even what he did next. He stood in front of the Buddha. Let the elephant destroy me, and I will protect my master. It was so cute, so sweet. A moment where Ananda could go down in history as the savior of the great Buddha. Unfortunately, it wasn't necessary. Get out of the way, Ananda. I can deal with this. So he pushed Ananda out of the way. He must be very crestfallen. And there was just the two of them. The great elephant, huge, powerful, drunk, out of his mind, smashing everything. And a calm, kind Buddha just walking gently in the direction of the charging elephant. It was like that old movie I saw as a kid, High Noon, where the sheriff and the gunslinger were about to meet at High Noon. One of them would die, who knows who. So it was High Noon in Rajagaha between Nalagiri and the Buddha. And as the elephant came towards him, the Buddha was strong. He had psychic powers. Now, that was attested in the books. He could have done anything with that elephant if he wanted to. As I said, he could have grabbed the elephant quickly by the trunk, just like some kung fu master. Now, this is a Buddha. This is way above kung fu masters. Not black belts, but, you know, the deep brown saffron belts. That's what the monks have. He could have grabbed it before the elephant knew and swung it around his head 3 times, because we always do things 3 times, 3 times around his head and thrown him way over the Ganges River, which is about 200-300 kilometers away from Rajagaha. No day's ride in the bus. He could have done that easily. That was nothing for a Buddha. But that's violence. The Buddha never used violence to stop the raging, charging elephant. He used kindness, loving kindness. And how would that work? And I use my metaphor for loving kindness, the door of my heart. I'd imagine the Buddha said something like this crazy mad elephant, Nalagiri, the door of my heart is open to you. It always will be, no matter what you do to me. You can crush me under your strong feet. You can pick me up and smash my body against a tree or a wall and kill me. But no matter whatever you do to me, Nalagiri, I will always love you. I will always forgive you. The door of my heart is always open to you, Nalagiri. Something like that. And the result of that this elephant, just, you can't kill or even harm someone like that. I said the other day about that monk I went to see in the north of Thailand, Ajahn Tay. He's just such a soft, beautiful monk when I saw him. There's no way you can harm him. Someone who has that really strong loving kindness. They're so gentle, they're so beautiful that it's like a little puppy. And you can't harm them. You just want to stroke them. That's what I wanted to do with Ajahn Tay, just stroke him, but that was not allowed. And that's exactly what happened with Nalagiri. He just saw this beautiful monk, had no anger, no fear, just kindness. And he stopped. And he bowed his head in front of the Buddha. And as the Buddha stroked Nalagiri on the trunk, there, Nalagiri, it's okay, Nalagiri. It's all right. Shh. And Nalagiri stopped in front of the Buddha. And that was one of the great events in the Buddha's life. How you could take a mad, crazy, intoxicated elephant and just calm it, not with force, but with this really, really strong kindness. And I've used that and taught that for people who have their mind becomes like a raging elephant, crazy, mad, charging, destroying everything. The times in meditation when you really just, you know, you're going crazy up the wall, down the wall, wherever. What do you do? Mind, it's okay, you can do whatever you like to me. The door of my heart's always open to you. I'd always love you. I'll never get angry at you, get afraid with you. You know, I love you, mind. And if you do things like that, it's incredible just how your mind, no matter how restless it is, no matter how crazy it is, it stops. And you're just like stroking your mind. There, mind, it's okay. I'm here. very nice that you calm down again. And that's actually how it happens, with the kindness. That is how you realize this moment you've always been trying to run away from. Now, they're always, what do I want, what do I want? It's not what you want, it's what you don't want was the problem. You don't want this moment right here because you're not appreciating it. When you're kind to it, the moment's kind back to you. If I smile at someone, they smile back again. If you smile at your mind, the mind smiles back. If you smile at the raging elephant smiles back at you. So it's what you give to what you're experiencing. That's what it shows you. These are insights into how to meditate. So you got your crazy, tired mind. Smile at it. And you find it smiles back. And you want to be there. And it's not a problem anymore. The elephant is not going to kill anybody. It's bowing down before you. You've tamed your mind. So there's many experiences like that which give you what we call insights. Insights are not intellectual. You know, the intellectual insights is just philosophy, it's just reason. And my goodness, you know, that all my trust in reason was shattered when I did quantum physics. Because everything you saw in quantum physics was totally irrational, but it was true. Even one of the latest discoveries, at last, you know, with this is, you may have heard the word, you don't need to understand it, quantum entanglement. The outcome of that is to, for once, they prove, without a shadow of doubt, that the effect precedes the cause, not the other way around. So you have the effect and that constructs the cause. The effect causes the cause, not the cause causes the effect. And that is totally ridiculous. It's totally illogical. It takes a very, very big mind to actually to grasp what that really means. But what it does tell you is your thinking, your rational process is so limited and it can only go so far, whereas the truth goes for much further. And which is one of the reasons why that you can't get insight through contemplating. You can only get insight through experiencing. Experiencing these things. So after a while you're meditating and you're not getting peaceful and still. What do you want, or rather what do I not want? And you find what you don't want and you let that one go, the negativity, through kindness, just allowing this mind and body to be, opening the door of your heart to this moment. And you find everything gets settled down, it gets very peaceful. You experience that calm happens. Wherever calm happens, that is because of insight. Insight is what leads to calm. It takes you downhill, closer to enlightenment. And if it's going the opposite direction, it's not insight. Insight leads to calm. And so often, you know, even in my meditation, sometimes you get blocked. You say, well, no, why is the nimitta not coming up? You know, I've got my delightful breath, it's all happening. Why? You know what I do? I stop myself and say, what do I want? And there's always something I want there. And it's usually, I want the nimitta, I want the jhanas, I want something. That is the problem. And I stop and develop insight. Exactly what do I want? Once I see it, once you see the wanting, immediately it vanishes, it goes. And then you get very peaceful. This is the Buddhist metaphor of Mara. For those of you who read some Buddhist text, you see that one of the chief characters in Buddhism is this fellow called Mara, M-A-R-A. And sometimes, I think somebody saw there's a perfume on sale called Mara perfume. And say it probably is. That's appropriate for Mara to make a perfume to entice people. But this Mara, he's actually in the Buddhist cosmology that he is a god who is the head, the boss of the heavenly realms who exert power over others. Now, it is the bliss of power. And I've often noticed that when people get wealthy in life, they, first of all, they try and get wealthy in their business. And once they're wealthy, what do they do next? They usually become politicians. They'll become prime ministers and dictators. And why do they do that? They've got so much money, because even money's not good enough to get what they want. Now they have to exert power over others. And that's a big buzz for some people, you know, to tell people what to do and have power over them. It's a type of joy and happiness, the happiness of power, which is why people, you know, they sacrifice so many things to get that power. And this is the guy, the head control freak, the power-hungry Mara. And so what really upsets Mara is when somebody gets out of his power. And that's when they get into a deep meditation and jhana, they become enlightened. Mara hates that. It's one person he cannot control. You know, the monks in jhanas, nuns in jhanas, and enlightened beings can't control those at all. So that's why he doesn't like them at all. So in the many stories in Buddhism, you always have this Mara guy coming along and trying to stop you, you know, getting into deep meditation, trying to stop you becoming enlightened, anything. And the trick they use for the Buddha, you know, it had the normal stuff, you know, the dancing girls, but it was fascinating. If you ever look at that story, it was, you know, even in those days, they understood how men think. Because they had the dancing girls, first of all, and that wasn't affecting the Buddha at all. So Mara turned the dancing girls into old women and dancing in front of the Buddha, because he said, man's tastes are various. I thought that Mara guy, he had it together. He knew what, you know, men thought. You know, all sorts of it. It's not just a beautiful girl. Some guys like fat women. Some people like ugly women. Some people like old women. It's weird, some people. So anyway, he tried that and that never worked. But then he tried, you know, something even more powerful to tempt the Buddha. Why be a Buddha? You could be this great leader of the world, lead it out of poverty, lead it out of war, make a utopia of this earth. You have the power and the means to do that. It's very tempting, isn't it, to solve the world's problems or become enlightened. And the Buddha actually saw that, you know, those problems can't be solved that way. He became enlightened and then he solved the world's problems in a much better way. But Mara was always trying to trick him. And the way to overcome Mara was not just to punch him in the nose or kick him in the bum. The Buddha said, I know you, Mara. That's all he needed to say. I know you. I recognize what you're up to. And then Mara would leave immediately. Now that is a great symbol of insight. I know what you're up to, mind. And then as soon as you see it, it vanishes. Whatever problem was in the meditation, if you really see it and got the insight into the blockage, into the hindrance, into the obstacle, as soon as you see it, you don't have to push it away. You don't do anything. Just seeing it, the insight, is enough to send Mara away. So a lot of times you're meditating, you know, you may sort of have a sore tummy or something, and it's blocking you. Insight. I know you, Mara. It's just a tummy, that's all. It's not going to kill me. It's the fear you're trying to generate, and just let it be. I'm just going to be with my tummy, which is a bit sort of painful, that's all. No problem, you can still be peaceful. If it's a case of, you know, people making noise, they're really noisy and noisy. The insight is the sound, you're disturbing the sound. As soon as you see that, the problem's gone. You know, when you are getting into the breath and it's not delightful enough, why isn't it delightful? You see, it is because many of you are afraid of happiness. There's a great insight you get into your nature. Why can't happiness come? Why, as soon as it comes, do I throw it away? Because many of us have been conditioned to think that we don't deserve happiness. And you've been told by your kids, by your parents, you're not good enough. By your teachers, you're not good enough. By your boyfriends, you're not good enough. By your girlfriends, you're too selfish. Whatever it is. We've always been told by others you're not good enough. And that has got so deeply ingrained into us that when we start to get happy and blissed out and close to enlightenment, no, not me. I can't do this. I'm not good enough. You see that straight away in insight. As soon as you see it, this is stupid. What do you mean I'm not good enough? And Mara just leaves you, and then you can get the happiness and the bliss. So many great insights actually come when you meditate. In fact, every time there's a blockage in a meditation, that is the coal face of insight, as they say. That's where insight is happening. Whenever you get a problem, it's giving you a test. If you get the insight, you pass the test, then you go on to the next stage and level. So throughout the whole of meditation, there's insight after insight after insight after insight comes up on your way. You know, why can't you let the body go? You must be attached to your body somewhere in some particular way, otherwise it will just vanish. What are you holding on to this body for anyway? You know, it's aching, it's pain, it's old. So what's the big deal with it? Why are you disturbing the sound? Somebody's talking outside. They're not talking about you. I promise you. Sometimes you think, are they talking about me? Look, you're not that important. They're not talking about you at all. So leave it alone. But why is it that we keep sort of, someone's talking, we're listening, what are they saying? Even if it's nothing to do with me. You can actually see just how you get attached to that sound and you just can't let it go. When you see why, you know, because of a bit of control and fear and thinking they're talking about me, once you can see that and realize they're not talking about you, you can just let them talk whatever they want. Once you realize it's the nature of people to talk, even during a retreat when you're not supposed to, they do anyway. It's their nature, it's very hard. All we can do is limit it. Limit it and try, please talk less. And when you do that, you realize it's other people, it's not you, so you can just let them be. You've got no control over them. You can hardly control yourself, so how can you control other people? So that way, you have the insight into letting go. And every obstacle in meditation, every problem, is not solved by willpower. Sometimes it's like you come across a brick wall. Too many people, they bang their head against a brick wall. They rush at it. They try and break through it. And actually, I was recently, when I was in England, that I was visiting my friend up in Cambridge and going around the university. And from there, I was going to the Sri Lankan temple in Chiswick. And I had a train ticket which went through King's Cross. And my friend told me, don't forget to check out platform 9 3/4 in King's Cross, the Harry Potter platform. Because apparently that in the books that Harry Potter would actually go to platform 9 3/4 and he would take his trolley and he'd make a run at the wall and push it through the wall and go into the platform only if you were a wizard. Apparently in King's Cross station in London, so many people have asked all the people working there, where's platform 9 3/4? Where's platform 9 3/4? They've actually created a platform 9 3/4 in King's Cross Station. And they've got a big sign, platform 9 3/4, and they've got a trolley which is bricked into the wall, like halfway through. And they've got this long queue of people to have their photograph taken in London's King's Cross, platform 9 3/4, with the trolley. And they've also got a scarf from his school. What's his school called? Hogwarts School. A Hogwarts School scarf, which they just loan to a person. They put around their neck, and they take the photograph, and then next, please. I thought it was quite cute, you know, just... I never got my photograph taken, but I took a squeeze and had a look, and there it was. But pushing your head against the brick wall, that just gives you, unless you're a wizard, you won't go through it. You just get a sore head. And that's what people do when they come across a problem in their meditation, trying to push their way through. What insight is, you just stand back a little bit and you see to the left, there's a gate which is open. To the right, there's a ladder which goes across. I remember seeing on a news program once, they had a big detention center in the middle of Australia for refugees. And they had this big gate with razor wire, and you can see on either side the razor wire fence, and they showed it, you know, on the clip which somebody showed me, this big razor wire enclosure for the refugees. But when the camera went back, they found the razor wire only went a couple of feet either side of the gate because the government ran out of money. the gate. But they didn't need the gate, just walk around it. Because they ran out of money to build the rest of the wall. Oh, the governments are like that, they're really good fun. Sometimes. But that's just like the blockages in meditation. If you can just look back a bit, there's all opening on the other side. You don't have to keep banging your head against it. That's insight. So look back and don't just keep doing the same old thing. Look back, find out what's going on, and use some very smart wisdom. This is maybe, what do I not want? What do I want? But when it gets to the very nice insights, when you really get deep and try to understand not just how to meditate, but actually why, what's going on in here, you see that every time you want something, it's trying to control things. And every time you actually do control and put forth effort, you know, you may notice with your insight that what you're really building up is your sense of self, your ego. Well, how much have you achieved in your life? Every time you achieve something, that builds your ego a little bit stronger. Every time you lose, every time you fail, your ego's being diminished a little bit more. Which is one of the reasons why I love failure. In fact, the more you fail, the more you lose, the more you detach. The more you realize you are out of control. This world doesn't run according to your schedule. The aircraft is late. Or the bus never leaves on time. Your wife comes home late. It doesn't run according to schedule, this world. You can't control it. You can't even control your own body. It gets sick. You've tried to find this wonderful time to meditate 9 days, and after a couple of days, you're sick. That really is unfair. Why does it happen now when I can meditate? You find you can't control things in life. Do you try and control your mind? Okay, I'm going to watch the breath now. I'm going to sit meditation now. Can you do that? If you're honest, you say you can't. You try, but you keep failing. So you find that this is ego, the sense of self, thinking that you own the mind. I mentioned this in the first talk. People treat their mind like a slave, treat their body like a maid as well. Forcing their body to do all sorts of things to bend to your will. It can work up to a point in life, but after a while the body just says, no, I'm not doing it anymore. And the body rebels against your will, and your body does what it wants to do, like getting old and getting sick and dying. That's your body telling you who's really in charge, not you. And it's the same with your mind as well. It tells you eventually in meditation who's in charge. It's not you. You cannot control your mind. Why? Because it's not yours. Not me, not mine, not a self. And that was the central teaching in the Buddha's second sermon, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutra. One of my favorite ones. It is an excellent little teaching. But it was a teaching which created the first fully enlightened beings after the Buddha. Now the Dhammacakka created the first stream winner, Kodanya. But then when the Buddha taught the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, his second sermon, all his five disciples all became arahat. Why? And it's because he said, no, this body, put it in terms of five khandhas, you know, basically the body and the four mind khandhas, you know, feeling, perception, mental formations, which includes will, and consciousness, knowing. That's four khandhas. And the body khandha. And he says, you can't control these things. You can't control consciousness. And if you could, it would be yours, but it doesn't belong to you. It's its own thing. You can't even control your will. Hee hee hee. You always think you can, but you don't. In this retreat, I'm controlling your will. I'm telling you when you can have breakfast. I'm telling you when you can have lunch. And other people are controlling it as well. I remember just reading that and just going, wow, is that what the Buddha really meant? Wow, I can't control anything. So once you realize you can't control your meditation, you've only got one choice, just let it go. Stop trying to control things which are out of your power, which do not belong to you. And so when you see that, you get the insight, none of this belongs to me, you just sit here and do nothing. It's not my mind. It's not my consciousness. It's not my body. You just happen to be in it for a while. And that's where I developed the great simile of the visitor rather than being an owner. That's the simile. First of all, I developed it to have an easy life as a monk, as an abbot. Because many of you know that it's not just going and teaching you meditation retreats. I've got a monastery over the road, and the monastery comes in here and asks me questions and has things to do about the monks and the nuns as well. So I had so much responsibility. On the weekend, going to Nolimara Center, our city center, and working my butt off there, talking to people, counseling about their marriages and about their kids, and I have never had kids, I've never been married, so what do I know? But they ask me anyway. Oh. So just Sunday evening, come back to monastery, and then Monday morning, back to work looking after monastery again. And all these people would be coming, like you guys, and say, oh, it's such a peaceful monastery. Oh, it's so beautiful. You're so lucky to live in this monastery. And I would look at them and say, are you joking? Are you mad? This is my work camp. And I have to do so much work here. Even building work. And cleaning up. And just talking to the monks. And talking to the lay people. And talking to the kangaroos. And anybody who asks a question. Not really the kangaroos, but I just exaggerated that. But you know what it's like. And I could not enjoy the monastery where I lived. And that really sort of shocked me, and I realized something was wrong. And so I developed this perception. Every Monday morning I used to do this. But you know, after breakfast until lunch, I would pretend. I'd pretend to be a visitor to the monastery in which I lived. No longer the abbot, no longer an owner, just a visitor, just like you. You go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, you're visiting. You know you're not the abbot, you're not one of the monks, you don't have any responsibilities and duties there. That's why you can enjoy it. It's nice and peaceful. If you want to go and meditate in the hall, you can meditate in the hall. You want to sit in a bell tower, you can sit in a bell tower. You want to go and make yourself a cup of tea in the kitchen, you can do whatever you want because you don't own it. You're a visitor. So that's what I did. I pretended to be a visitor. And the monk would come and ask me, said, I need to speak to you. Sorry. The abbot's not in today. I'm only visiting. And you guys would come and ask me a question. I say, nope, I'm only visiting today. I'm not the teacher. And it was brilliant when you were a visitor because then I could actually enjoy the monastery in which I lived. I could see it the same way you see it. But when I owned it, it was full of work and full of things to be changed and done and fixed when I owned it. When I visited, I could let it go. And that gave me the great insight how to meditate. I don't own my meditation. If I own my meditation, there's so many defilements to fix up, so many hindrances to overcome, so many jhanas to attain. That's if I own my meditation. Too much business. So instead, I just visit. I'm only visiting. I don't own. The sense of self goes when you're a visitor. When you're an owner, you make things happen. You possess and take responsibility for your meditation. You're going to have a lot of hard work. It'll be endless. And you can never enjoy your meditation. So I decided to use the inside of non-self. I'm only visiting when I meditate. Hi mind, how are you going? Well, I'm not going to try and control you. I don't own you. Body, I'm only visiting. I don't know, 80 years, 90 years, you're only a visitor. You don't own this body. You don't own this mind. You're just visiting it, seeing what it's like right now. And when you have the perception of a visitor, not an owner, life becomes so easy. You've got nothing to do. You don't have to get jhanas. You don't have to get enlightened anymore. Nothing to do. It's not my problem. You can just sit there and do nothing and enjoy. And then the jhanas come to you. Then enlightenment just drops out of the sky into your lap. That's how these things happen. But if you try and own them, then you've lost the plot. It's one of the reasons why when people keep asking you, Ajahn Brahm, you talk about these jhanas, Ajahn Brahm, but can you actually do them? I'll make a confession now. I'll make this confession every retreat. Ajahn Brahm cannot do jhanas. I can't attain them. I can't do the jhanas. I vanish first. Ajahn Brahm, bye-bye Ajahn Brahm. And then the jhanas happen. But I can't do them. Do you get the point? When I try to achieve anything, no way. Too much self, too much control. So Ajahn Brahm, disappear. I'm only visiting, I'm not the owner anymore. And then incredible things happen. Amazing things happen. That is one of the reasons why when people ask good monks, are you an arahant? Are you a stream winner? What are you talking about? Who the hell is a stream winner? Who the hell is those sort of an arahant? Anyone who says I'm an arahant, obviously they're not. No way. But this is actually, I remember hearing this. It's in one of the suttas, a great little saying of the Buddha. Because a monk came up to see the Buddha, and Ananda was sitting next to the Buddha as usual. The monk said, one who is fully enlightened, they don't think that they are better than somebody else, they're worse than somebody else, or the same as somebody else. I said, yeah, correct, absolutely right. They've got no sense of self. They can't say they're better, they're worse, or even the same. Being the same as everyone else is a Western illusion. We are all the same. The Buddha said, no way. And then another monk came up and said to the Buddha, one who is an arahat, finished their practice, fully enlightened, they never think they're the same, they're better or they're worse than anybody else. You know, precisely what the previous one had said. And the Buddha said, yeah, correct. And then the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, they were two arahats. That's how people say they're arahats. You know, there's nothing there. They're not better. They're not worse. They're not the same. There's nobody there. So, you know, who the hell's an arahant? They're not better. They're not worse. Not the same. And that's why one of the reasons why it's not we don't say because, you know, we don't want to say. It's because you can't say. It doesn't make any sense anymore. But when people start to do things like that, you know, you may know, if any of you are traditional Buddhist, that a person who is a stream winner, or once returned, a non-returner, or an arahat, they are called the Aryas. You know, that's the old name in the Buddha gave them, the Arya Sangha. And as monks, we never let on who is an Aryan and who is not. Because if you did, you'd be splitting up the Sangha. The Aryas and the non-Aryas, and creating what I call the Aryastocracy. I had to work hard for that joke, but but that's actually true, an Aryastocracy. You see the sort of stuff which that did to countries like England and France and stuff like that, and just totally split off one part of the population from another. And you never want to do that again, especially in something like Buddhism. So we don't create an Aryastocracy of the Aryan Sangha and the non-Aryan. So this is one of the reasons why when we understand non-self, great insight, there's nobody here, it means you can be a visitor, not an owner. Which means it's so much easier to let go. But if you own your meditation and look upon this as your like personal achievement, and this is where you're going to achieve so much for you in the spiritual materialism of meditation, you're lost. You're not going to get much peace and happiness. So stop trying to attain. Let attainments happen. Don't try to meditate. You disappear. Be a visitor, not an owner of your meditation. Those of you who've told me that you've had great meditations in the past, the reason why you can't get a nice meditation again is because now you've owned that old meditation. It's part of, it's a little certificate you have on the wall, like a degree or like any other certificates of achievement you have. You're owning it. That's why you can't get it back again. So please, everything you've ever achieved in the past, That's not who you are. That was somebody else. Throw that away. And instead, be a visitor to life who comes into Bodhinyana Monastery with no baggage. They can get so much happiness and peace there because they don't own the place. You go into your meditation, into your body and mind, like you visit Bodhinyana Monastery. Totally free, no baggage, and then you can fully enjoy the meditations. That's insight which leads to calm, which leads to peace. And eventually, you go deep enough under the crowd, you'll understand and see that, and how true that is. So there we go, that's insight for today. Da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da! Sadhu! Sadhu!